Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
It might have been the greatest upset since David slayed Goliath. The scrappy 1980 U.S. men's hockey team knocked off the mighty Soviets. It was the 1980 Olympics. 40 years ago, is that possible? When Coffey wrote the book, The Boys of Winter, Wayne, thank you for joining us. 40 years. Hard to believe.
Yeah, it's, and it just goes on and on, Peter. It's been 40, and it in some ways, it feels like it's been a week or two. It's just, it continues to be a timeless, magical moment in the annals of American sport.
There are so many things that made this a big deal. I want to get your thoughts. One thing that seems clear, the NHL players did not play in the Olympics. The Europeans did not play in the NHL. So the Soviets had what amounted to an all-star team, right?
It was a lot of people in hockey consider that 1980 Soviet team the greatest collection of hockey players in the history of the sport. They were absolutely a juggernaut. They were, in fact, a year before the Lake Placid Olympics, Peter, that same Soviet team that was in Lake Placid played the NHL All-Stars, and they won 6-0 against the NHL All-Stars with their backup goalie. So, I mean, this was as close to an unbeatable team as you could possibly have. And in fact, 13 days before they dropped the puck on February 22nd in Lake Placid, the Soviets and the U.S. played in Madison Square Garden, and the Soviets won 10-3, and they put the brakes on. So, as the coach said, Viktor Tikhonov, when I went to Moscow and talked to him, I said, "So were your players overconfident?" And he said, "They all said the 10-3 game would be no problem. It turned out to be a very big problem."
Right. So you've told us a little bit about the Soviets. What? Tell us about this U.S. squad. I mean, these were guys that did not play together typically, and what was it about this group of players?
Well, Herb Brooks, the coach of the team, said right from the outset, "I don't want the best players. I want the right players." And, I mean, certainly these were some great college players. A number of them went on to play and even star in the NHL. It was not some ragtag bunch by any means, but they were all but two of them were college kids, and they were going, and in a lot of ways it really was men against boys, and they really, the U.S. in the history of the world championships, the U.S. against Russia, against the Soviet Union, the Soviets were 28-0. They had never lost. They had crushed the U.S. team every time they'd played them since 1960. So they really had, quote-unquote, no chance. But the magic of Herb Brooks and what they did, and I really think, Peter, this is why this moment is just so enduring and so pure. There's so much to be cynical about these days, and these really were truly amateurs. They were playing for the love of the sport, the love of their country, and it was really, in a lot of ways, the last stand of the Cold War, and I think that's a big part of why this game is remembered. The Soviets had just invaded Afghanistan. The hostage crisis was going on in Iran. Anyone who was trying to buy a house in 1980 remembers that nightmare, because interest rates were like 17 or 18%. Inflation was horrible, and even President Carter was speaking about the crisis of the American spirit. So it was a very, it was a dispiriting time in the United States. And then along come these group of college kids against the big bad Russians, and they really made everybody feel pretty great all of a sudden.
It really was that us versus them mentality. And so you talked about the international backdrop, but what captivated people that 40 years later, people still remember this game? They still remember this team?
You know, I think it really has to do with the purity of it. I mean, these were the last small town Olympic Games we will ever see. Lake Placid was an Adirondack village of 2,800 people, 30 miles from the nearest interstate. When you go there and you drive into town and you think, how could they have possibly had an Olympic Games here? And they didn't do it without a difficulty. There was, you know, massive gridlock and bus shortage. People couldn't get anywhere in the beginning of the Games. So they had their hurdles. But I really think that, again, the message that, and the enduring message of this game is that, you know, if you really try your best, you stick together, you know, you just leave it all out there on the ice, and that, you know, somehow you get a good bounce or two, you know, maybe you can do the impossible. And, you know, and to speak to just the absolute improbability of it, Peter, one of the things that, if you think about it, I know this is the case for me, in most of the really, truly memorable moments going back decades and decades in your life are things that were horrific, were tragic. I could tell you exactly where I was standing in the hallway at Manor Plains School in Huntington, Long Island, on November 22nd, 1963, when I found out about President Kennedy being assassinated. Not much different with the Martin Luther King assassination, and then Robert Kennedy, and then, you know, fast forward to the Challenger. And I think, you know, decades from now, people are going to remember when they heard about this just god-awful, unspeakable Kobe Bryant tragedy with the 9 people dying in a helicopter. This is something that people remember exactly where they were, who they were with, how they felt, and it was a happy thing. And there's not many really happy things that achieve that kind of status in people's memory banks.
You wrote the book, The Boys of Winter, for the 25th anniversary 15 years ago. You got in depth with a lot of these guys. What impact did it have on them? I mean, you've talked about how it affected us, everybody else. This had to have upended their world and changed their lives forever.
It really did. And you know, again, part of the charm, when you talk to these guys, they were playing a hockey game that Friday night in Lake Placid. That's what they were doing. It was a really important hockey game, but they weren't going out there thinking about, you know, the Red Menace and the Soviet tanks and making the country feel great. You know, they just had their heads down and they were going to play 60 minutes of, you know, kick butt hockey is what they were going for. And but it had just an enduring, unshakable, lifelong impact on almost all of them in one way or the other. Mike Ruzioni, the captain of the team who scored the winning goal with 10 minutes left, and no slight to Mike. It was an incredible achievement, and he was a completely admirable player, left it all out on the ice. But, I mean, this was really like one sort of ugly goal. He was like off balance, wrong foot, kind of hit a wobbly puck that got past the Soviet goalie, Vladimir Mishkin, who was in the game because the Soviet coach, in a fit of complete rage, when Tretiak, the starting goalie, let in a last-second goal at the end of the first period. Tretiak was Babe Ruth in goal. I mean, this guy was probably the all-time greatest goaltender, and Tikhanov pulled him from the game. And again, this is like, you know, pinch hitting for the Babe or Joe DiMaggio in the World Series. The American guys couldn't believe. He really took Tretiak out of the game? Oh, my. The backup goalie comes in, and Ruzioni scores this goal, and he's basically made a living out of that goal. He's now works for Boston University as a fundraiser, and you know, who wouldn't want to play a round of golf with Michael Ruzioni? You hear great stories, then you write a big fat check, and he's also a wonderful motivational speaker, and you know, it's earned him, as his teammates like to tease him, like it's earned him a lifetime on the rubber chicken circuit. So,
well, it's funny you talk about the Soviets and the Americans. I mean, that's the beauty of America. You have the opportunity to cash in, and if you can still cash in 40 years later, all the better.
Yeah, I mean, and in the minutes, and oh, another really, it's sweet almost. Unfathomable detail about this game, but so it's played at a Friday night in Lake Placid at 5 p.m. It was shown on ABC on tape, 3-hour tape delay. This was not the sports moment of the 20th century, was not even shown on live television, and it was possible to not know the outcome then. This was before anyone really ever heard of it. You could not check Twitter. And then after the game, so Ruzioni scores the goal. Then they have what Ken Morrow, the stellar defenseman on that team, called the longest 10 minutes of his life. So they have this 4-3 lead, this little arena on a hilltop in Lake Placid, which has since been named for Herb Brooks, is just quaking. And there's nonstop chanting, USA, USA. And the whole building is like just riotous and like one big goosebump. And the clock's ticking down, 9 minutes, 8 minutes, 7 minutes. And the Soviets are putting pressure on like crazy on Jim Craig, the goalie, and it's building. And can they do it? And the tension was just, it was just went from one end of the Adirondacks to the other. And so they finally have, you know, they get down to the final seconds. Al Michaels does his famous countdown. And when they won, and there's just this explosion of delirium like no one had ever seen. And after they change, they go out into, they just walk out onto Main Street, Lake Placid, which had turned into Miracle Boulevard. And they're surrounded by thousands of fans. And the whole, everyone in town, they're chanting USA, USA. There's a little liquor store across the street. They got wiped out of champagne in about 2 minutes. And it's snowing, of course, Lake Placid in February. And the players, one after another, would just talk about the memory of just being swept along in this crowd in the snow with the chants of USA, USA ringing in their ears.
You know, and some people, if they don't follow hockey, might not remember, this was not the gold medal game. So what was that like for them to have to turn around and say, you know, we've reached the apex, but we're not done. We haven't won a gold medal yet.
Yeah, that because it was such an iconic game. A lot of people do think that was the end. No, this was the semifinal. So, in fact, it's funny. Herb Brooks, who was not only an absolutely brilliant coach who completely changed the whole style of American hockey in putting together this team, had spoke to the team in the locker room inside the arena, now named for him, before that game. And all he said to them was, you were born to be a player. This moment is yours. And you were born to be a player. This moment is yours. And it's, and then they went out and crushed it. At 35-second shifts at a time. And that's what he told him. He said, you just win your 35-second shift. And 2 days later, they have to play Finland. If they don't beat Finland, there's a chance they would get no medal at all. Forget a goal. They could get shut out of the medals. So, I mean, Herb has to really rein these guys in. And because they show up for practice Saturday, they're, you know, everyone wants their autograph. They're like the biggest stars in town. And he's just riding their butts big time. Like, you guys aren't nothing. You know, you've got to. So after that mystical motivational speech Friday night. He comes into the locker room before the Finland game on Sunday morning, and he says, I have to clean up the language a little bit. He said,
please.
He said, if you lose this bleeping game, you'll take it to your grave. So talk about the highs and lows of motivational speaking.
He was probably right.
He hit the exact nerve. I mean, the backup goalie, Steve Janizak, when Herb said that, he said, I flash forward to myself as a 45-year-old guy sitting in a bar with a beer by myself, like pounding the bar saying, God, if we had only beaten Finland, we could have won the gold medal, you know? So, yeah, Herb always knew what note to play, and he played it brilliantly.
He was a complicated figure and not particularly well-loved. He became loved by the fans because of what he accomplished, but his relationship with the players was complicated, I guess.
It was, you know, I think after the fact, in fact, I begin the book with the setting the scene of Herb's funeral when he died in 2003. And on one eerie note, I was actually scheduled to interview him at 8:30 on the day that he died. We were going to talk on the phone. He was coming back from a fundraiser for the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame, and it was August, dry roads, good conditions, and apparently he just fell asleep at the wheel. His car rolled, and it was just, he was 66 years old, and the players, of course, all turned out. Mike Arizioni gave a wonderful eulogy, and but he was a guy who they loved after the fact, almost like you think about, you know, maybe one of the best teachers you had or one of the best coaches who drove you, pushed you, made you really uncomfortable. He made these guys excruciatingly uncomfortable and very much kept his distance from them because he didn't want personal connections to affect any of his decisions. So, I mean, he was the quintessential hard-ass coach and left the bad cop, so to say, and the good cop was the assistant coach, Craig Patrick. So, you know, Herb would just push them unmercifully and play mind games with them all the time. Like, you know, right before the Olympics, Jim Craig was his starting goalie, and Herb Brooks comes up to him and says, you know what, you're really not on top of your game. I think I'm going to go with Janizak now. And Craig just exploded. He'd been the number one goaltender. They're on the eve of the Olympics. And, you know, how can you do this? And, you know, Craig gets in his face. He says, this is my job. You can't give this away. And Herb wasn't going to make any change. He was just, you know, he was messing with him to make sure that he knew.
He was pushing buttons.
Pushing buttons. He was the master button pusher. And it didn't make for any sense of comfort or complacency, but he knew if they were going to win this game, they could not have a shred of that. So, I mean, that was a big part of his genius.
What about the bond that these guys formed together? And are they still in touch? Are they close? What's your sense of that?
Yeah, they have reunions. They're going to have, I believe, their 40th reunion. They're actually going to Las Vegas, not Lake Placid. I'll be in Lake Placid, but...
you got the wrong spot.
Yeah, I don't know. I love Lake Placid.
In February,
yeah. You got to be a hardy soul. But the beauty, that town really has not changed much. In fact, the arena where they played this game, it's a time warp. You walk in the locker room 5 where the U.S. Changed, where they dressed for the game and, you know, where they went after the game. It's just, it looks like a little, like, no-frills high school locker room. It's the same as it ever was. So there's something that's really charming about the fact that time has sort of stood still in that village. So I'm glad I'm going to Lake Placid. I'll just make sure I, you know, bring warm weather gear.
These guys, are they still tight?
Yeah, I think, you know, they're...
I mean, tight, I don't want to overstate it, but the fact is they don't scatter to the winds as other teams do that don't have this powerful bond.
No, they have a very special bond. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, and I think for a lot of them, what's tricky, I mean, imagine achieving this, the greatest sports moment of the 20th century when you're 21 or 22, or like Neil Broughton, the youngest guy in the team, just turned 19. I mean, that can really mess with your head. I mean, what do you – And some of the guys really struggled with that, like sort of like, what can I, you know, you've been to the mountaintop, as high a mountaintop as you'll ever find in sports. And, you know, what do you do next? And, you know, almost all of these guys have found their way and had, you know, had productive lives and, you know, have kids and now grandchildren. I mean, it's so funny to think about these guys as grandfathers, but so many of them are just like, you know, regular lunch pail guys. So in the course of doing the book, I got very friendly with a very close friend of Mark Johnson, and I spoke to Mark's wife, Leslie. So Mark is a, you know, the proverbial rink rat, the coach, the son of Bob Johnson, who coached the University of Wisconsin. Badger Bob won a Stanley Cup with the Pittsburgh Penguins later. But Badger Bob and Herb Brooks were mortal sworn enemies, so much so that Mark didn't even know if Herb Brooks would pick him for the team. And Mark Johnson, they called him Magic. He was the original Magic Johnson. Mm-hmm. Herb Brooks was not going to not pick the best player because he didn't like the guy's father. But Mark is just, now, as I said, he's now the a record-setting coach of the Badger women's team. But a couple of, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, he and his wife, they had five kids. They're cleaning out their house. Kids are leaving. You know, they got all this stuff they've collected. So they have a garage sale. And Mark's friend comes over helping him arrange stuff, and he sees a pair of hockey gloves on a bench for $3. And he said, "What are those?" And he said, "Oh, those are my gloves." And he said, "From where?" He said, "Oh, those are the gloves I used in Lake Placid." And he said, "Wait a minute, you're selling your gloves from Lake Placid for $3? He said, "Yeah, I mean, who would want them? I just want to get a couple bucks." And he said, "You are such an idiot." And then he said, just to prove his point, he got, Mark still had his hockey pants from Lake Placid. And he said, "Give me those things." And his friend, she said, he asked Mark, "You want them?" And Mark said, "No." He said, "I'm putting on sale for eBay." And he sold them for $1,200. So,
right.
So his friend pulled those hockey gloves out of the garage sale.
This was 40 years ago. The book was now 15 years ago. When you look back, talking to all these guys, what is there a story or a moment that sticks with you where you think, wow, that was really something?
You know, I guess a couple of things come to mind. One is I Ken Morrow, the great defenseman, then went up, won four Stanley Cups with the Islanders, is still the Islanders' director of pro scouting. Just the nicest man you could ever meet. And Ken said he's estimated that he's gotten over 10,000 cards, letters, and and every time he meets someone, they want to, like what we were talking about before, they want to tell him their story, where they were, how they felt, who they were with. And, you know, the fact that that has endured that way is really pretty magical. But you know what, Peter, to me, the real core of this story, and this is why I love working on the book so much. I mean, we all know the outcome, but what I really try to tunnel into is the journey of the players and how they came to be on the ice that night. And one story that always stuck with me was about Steve Janicek, the backup goalie, who, by the way, he was an All-American, won two national championships playing for Herb Brooks at the University of Minnesota, and he never played 1 second in Lake Placid. He was the only athlete in those entire games in any sport who did not play. Even when the Americans had a 5 or 6 goal lead against the Romanians, Herb Brooks did not put this guy who helped him win two national championships. And Janicek was so classy about that. He said, "I'm not bitter." He said, "I had the best seat in the house for the greatest sports moment of the century. How could I be bitter?" He also met his wife in Lake Placid. But what I just wanted to share was, so Steve Janicek is, you know, coming up as a hockey player. He's a talented goalie. He lives in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, and his father was an electrician. And his father would work all day. He'd come home. They would then have a little bite of supper at, you know, 6 o'clock. And then the father had a car. I remember Ramblers. Our younger listeners will not. What the heck is a Rambler? Well, that was a car. And they would get in the family Rambler and they'd drive over to the lake, and Steve's father would park the Rambler. No lights, of course. It's a lake. It's the middle of winter. It's dark. And he puts the Rambler on the edge of the lake, leaves it running, puts the lights on, and he plays hockey with his son, shoots pucks at his son. They play, they skate, they're out there for an hour or two, just about every single night of Steve's life. And, you know, it's what good parents do. It's what how father and sons connect and how families connect. And every single one of these guys have a variation of that story of the team, the coaches, the villages, who raised them and kind of lifted them up to this moment. And those were the stories that that I really cherished finding out about, because it doesn't just happen by accident that you reach this level and you have this kind of makeup to be able to achieve something like this.
You know, something you said earlier as we wrap up was the clock ticking down in the final 10 minutes, and that's my memory of just watching the clock and just wondering, can they hold on? Can they fend yep. off this onslaught from the Soviets? And it really was so tense.
Oh, it was unrelenting. And the other thing, you know, the scoreboard, I have a book, we're talking, all the records show the final score was US 4, USSR 3. But the Russians, the Soviets outshot the Americans that night 39-16. It was not an even game. I mean, they had to. Jim Craig played out of his mind, and you know, the defensemen blocked shots, and everybody just, you know, every single 35-second shift, they left it out there. But yeah, as the clock is ticking down, it's just like this is never ever going to end. We're never going to get there. And then, you know, when they did, it was just like a moment for all times. But not for the Soviets. I told one guy, Sergei Makarov, great guy who ended up being a big star in the NHL. He told me when he got his silver medal, he went back to the Athletes' Village, which is now a federal prison, where the Athletes stayed is a federal prison 8 miles outside of Lake Placid. And he took his silver medal and he dropped it in the garbage in the Athletes' Village. He wasn't interested in a silver.
40 years later, we're still talking about that 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team. 15 years later, we're talking about the Boys of Winter. Wayne Koff is the author. Wayne, thanks so much for coming in and joining us.
My pleasure. We'll have to do it again when we hit the 100th anniversary, Peter.
Can't wait.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly.